Welcome to the Exalt Podcast. My name is Christopher Shagnon.
And I'm Sophia Hagelani-Alba. We are really excited about the guest that we are going to have today. If any of our listeners happen to be at the Finnish Society for Development Research's Development Days in February 2022, they had the pleasure of hearing a fantastic keynote speech from our guest today. We are so lucky to get to have her join us as well. Tanya Lee, would you like to say hello to our audience?
Hi, thank you for the invitation. I'm a professor of anthropology, University of Toronto in Canada. Happy to be an anthropologist. Seems to me kind of rather a wonderful discipline. But I have a lot of crossover interests in geography, development, environmental studies, related really to the themes of my work. I am, I would say, mainly a scholar, a researcher, a writer, also a teacher, and I enjoy my teaching role. I'm not an activist, I would say, but I do see my research and teaching as forms of political engagement in the sense that, you know, what we choose to study, what we write about, what we teach, who we choose to collaborate with, you know, there's a whole world of commitments behind the choices that we make as academics. And I have to say that we as academics are uniquely privileged in the amount of autonomy we have to decide how to dedicate our energy and our time, you know, to the research and teaching, you know, and collaboration that makes sense to us. I think few other professions have that degree of autonomy. You know, mostly you're told what to do with your time. And within reason, you know, we can choose, you know, and I've really appreciated that aspect of my academic role. So that's a little introduction to who I am.
Thank you for that fantastic introduction. And yeah, totally agree. It's such a wonderful thing to have this autonomy and to be able to dive into these areas that we find fascinating. So I guess for our listeners at home, especially those who weren't able to see your wonderful keynote, what have you been diving into lately? What's been really catching your interest?
I think really from the beginning of my career as a researcher, I've always been interested in what I think of as political economic questions. I think these were very well summarized by Henry Bernstein and his famous, now famous haiku, you know, the question of who owns what, who does what, who gets what do they do with the surplus? Like basically those questions which have to do with livelihood, you know, how people are able to live. I think those questions get us into the core of livelihoods, but also production, profit, exploitation, inequality. Like all of those themes really come back to those fundamental questions of like who owns what, who does what, you know, who gets the surplus and what do they do with it. So those have been really core themes of my work. And I have had a particular focus for the last 30 years on rural societies, on agrarian societies. And the reason for that is, again, you know, going back to the politics of it, you know, 50% of the world's population still lives in rural areas and still survives primarily from agriculture. So even though, or in whole, or, you know, if not in whole, then certainly in part. So even though we're told that the world is urbanizing and the percentage of people in urban areas is going up, the total number of people trying to live and survive in rural areas is actually more than ever. More that people than ever are in fact living in rural spaces and making their livelihoods there. So in a period when, you know, the excitement has been the urban, perhaps the migrant, perhaps the cultural spaces, communications, media. I've kept my focus pretty squarely on what I call sort of muddy places and muddy topics, where half the world's people are also still engaged, as it turns out. But people who are often a bit out of sight and out of mind in terms of academic discourse, at least in recent years. And that includes my own discipline of anthropology, which used to really have a focus, I would say, on, you know, muddy places. But increasingly, that isn't, you know, a popular topic in anthropology, at least in North America, although in Europe and in Scandinavia, I think it's much more balanced. So good for that. But those are the kinds of places where I've focused my work. And I did actually start off doing a PhD in urban anthropology, but since my postdoc days in the 1990s, so that is 30 years, I've really focused on the rural. And the questions that I like to ask of these places is, you know, what's going on there? How are people living? No doubt it's not the kind of static village, if it ever was. Surely it never was. These are rural spaces, which in my experience are extremely dynamic. You know, there's a lot of change. Things are changing in relation to land, in relation to labor, in relation to how people are surviving, livelihoods, political aspirations. You know, these are very lively places. And those are the questions that I've been really engaging with. You know, what's going on in the rural areas and how can we make sense of it?
I think that those rural areas are so interesting. I also like to center my research. I love that conceptualization, the muddy places. Like I definitely am going to probably take that forward, like in my own conceptualization. That's great. So land and the earth. I know that in your recent work, you've been specifically working with oil palm plantations in Indonesia. What brought you to that particular type of land as an object of study?
Right. So like most research, you know, this has a lot of prehistory and previous projects, which kind of led me to that place. So on the one hand, in the book that I published called Land's End, Capitalist Relations on an Indigenous Frontier. This was also in Indonesia, the island of Sulawesi. And what I was tracking there was what was happening among smallholders, among ordinary farmers. You might think of them as indigenous people. They were living up in a mountain, had a land sharing system, were engaged in food and cash crop production. And during the period of my research there, which began in 1990 and went on for 20 years, the period covered in that book, major transformations occurred. Like during that period, they, off their own initiative, decided to start planting cocoa trees, which they thought would be a dynamic new crop, give them more security and more income. And the fact of planting these cocoa trees had the effect of enclosing previously common land, because in their own understanding, once you've planted trees on it, it's yours, because trees are a long term. So I tracked that process, basically a dynamic process among smallholders, which led to both the privatization of land and eventually what I considered to be capitalist relations, in the sense that their capacity to hold onto their land came to depend on their efficiency in production. Farmers who were not able to establish viable cocoa farms lost their land, you know, went into debt to their traders, and those who were able to set up viable enterprises expanded. So it was kind of capitalism 101, like you might see in an economics textbook. And that was remarkable, right? So why do you get such fiercely competitive capitalist relations on an indigenous frontier? Not the kind of place you might expect to find it, but that was the drama and the story that I tracked in that book. And then after that, I did another project together with two colleagues, a geographer and a political scientist, Phil Hirsch and Derek Hall. And together, the three of us took a look right across the Southeast Asian region. We were all Southeast Asia specialists, to see what was happening with land. Like, how were people either holding on to it or losing access to it? We called that book Powers of Exclusion, Land Dilemmas in Southeast Asia. And what we realized was that the process I had tracked in Land's End of kind of smallholder-based dispossession was one kind of process, which was common across the region, happened in many places. There were other processes too. So one was the expansion of boom crops and plantations. Another was the acquisition of land for infrastructure, you know, dams and roads and so on, especially economic zones, what we called post-agrarian land uses, you know, where some other use came in and took over large areas of land. Conservation was another form of exclusion, you know, countries that have committed themselves to certain areas of protected forest, we're in the process of hardening forest boundaries so that the farmers who previously had lived in those areas and who'd been able to gradually expand into the forest, you know, one generation to the next, and now we have a new generation and they need a bit more land and they nibble away at the forest. Like that's been the common pattern in Southeast Asia until I would say the last 30 years. But those borders were also hardening with conservation agendas, you know, more commitment to actually blocking off the forest from smallholder use. And we also, in that book, looked at kind of what we called ethno-territorial kinds of exclusion, where the land is still there, but whether who can access it in some parts of the region came to depend increasingly on identity, who you are. Are you the right kind of person to be in this place? So this could both be indigeneity kinds of claims, you know, we the indigenous people should be here, you migrants should not be here. It could also have to do with other kinds of sort of exclusionary ethnic politics and so on. So, the, you know, the sort of the identity dimension was also something which came into our study. Anyway, so that was a broad sweep across the Southeast Asian region. And for an anthropologist, it was my first experience of writing about places where I hadn't done my own field work. So I did a ton of reading. And, you know, we were, the three of us, were guided also by colleagues who helped us to see, you know, where we had gone astray in the literature. But that was an attempt to do a kind of macro level. I mean, it's very detailed, it's very empirical, but we were trying to look at what are the big processes going on across the region. So turning then to the plantation. So what I came to realize, you know, in that context really of doing that book, is that although plantations were not big in the main areas I had studied in Sulawesi, in other parts of the region, this plantation format, which I'd always thought of as like old colonial done past, was actually re-emerging in a really major way. You know, large scale plantations across the region were coming back. If they ever went away, they were expanding. And that was really another type of major shift in the rural economy that and rural life and livelihood that I should pay attention to. So that was when I decided, together with my colleague Edgar Jamada, Pujo Smedi, who's an economic anthropologist like me, that's when we decided that we together would take a look at the expansion of plantations, specifically oil palm plantations, which in Indonesia, the expansion really started around 2000. So, you know, we're talking about 20 years of massive transformational expansion linked to that particular crop. And that was what we wanted to grasp. But as anthropologists, we wanted to pay attention to what we call the forms of life. So not just at the level of, you know, land is being grabbed, forests are being destroyed, customary communities are being displaced. Like all of that is true. Lots of damage and loss, one could say. And much of the literature talks about that damage and loss. Much of the critical literature talks about that. But we decided that we should really focus on what is installed. Like, what is it like to live in the plantation zone? What kind of life is it when you live in the shadow of a massive corporate enterprise, or sometimes a dozen corporate enterprises back to back, saturating, you know, entire districts of rural Indonesia, which is now the case, right? Historically in Sumatra, but also now massive areas of Kalimantan are back-to-back, wall-to-wall plantations. And yet a lot of people still live there. So how are they living? What is the form of life? Those are the questions that we thought we should answer. So coming to the plantation work, like I said, it was sort of that pathway. You know, I worked on the dynamics of smallholder agriculture and the changes there. And then there's this other kind of agriculture, the large-scale corporate agriculture, which also transforms things radically, but in quite different ways. So that was the reason for moving into this topic, and it's taken us 10 years. We started the work in 2010, and the book has just come out now in 2021. So, you know, a new research project, a new area for me, less so for Pujo, I'd say, because he was already a plantation specialist, but I wasn't. So, you know, a ton of reading on plantations, their history, their colonial history, and then, you know, fresh field work, writing, and all the rest of it. So, yeah, you can't do too many new topics in one career, but there's lots of continuity with what I have done before, even though this was definitely a new field and a new set of issues.
Thank you. I mean, yeah, that is such a huge thing, and especially going in there and all the background that it takes to build up and become an expert. And also in such an important area too, because plantations are spreading very much across like West Africa and such as the global supply chain pushes on. But I'm really fascinated. You're saying these people are living in the shadows of these plantations. Like, what's it like there? What is it like for these people who presumably it used to be forced or more like a different sort of surrounding? What is it like? You know, what does it smell like? What does it feel like to be in these plantations or to be in the shadows of these plantations?
Yes. So that's very much topic of our research. And I think the first thing that we realized when we started the work was that we had to map out the different social groups in the plantation zone, each of which would have somewhat different relations to the plantation, right? It's not one thing. So we started out by mapping the two of us on a motorbike for a month, going around different hamlets and worker barracks and so on, like through the two plantations that we had chosen to study. You know, one was a state plantation, one was a privately owned plantation, but the latter was attached to a transmigration site with smallholders. So there was a spectrum, you know, of types of plantation and therefore types of life, you know, different forms of life, depending on where you were. And then, you know, thinking about plantation workers, there are the full-time employed permanent workers who sometimes have reasonably good labor conditions, you know, housing, pensions, health schemes, and so on. And then there's the casual and outsourced workers who have none of the above. Like, who were the permanent workers? Who were the casual workers? What was the relationship between them? And then the smallholders tied to the corporation in these schemes, which are based on debt, you know, which are based on a bond. Like, what kind of life was that? And then for people who were the former landholders, you know, who used to be farming in these areas before the plantations, what's become of them? Where are they? How are they living? And then the people who were beyond the reach of the corporation, like the people who were still living up in the upriver areas beyond the plantation borders, what are they doing? You know, how are they living? Are they affected by the plantation? Do they want to be part of it? Do they want a plantation to come on their land too or not? You know, there are so many different questions as you think of the plantation zone, as we call it, as a variegated space in which there are different social groups with different relationships to this corporate structure. And then even within the structure, right, there's the managers and the workers, and then there's the local officials. You know, they have the job of smoothing the way for the plantations. That's their official role. You know, they're appointed to coordination teams, officially mandated and paid to support the plantation. But on the other hand, they're supposed to be protecting the population. You know, they're supposed to be the guardians of the people living under their umbrella. It's a hierarchical, paternalistic kind of state system. But in a paternalistic state system, you do have some responsibility for your children, right? And if your children are being damaged by a corporate plantation, like, you find yourself stuck, you know, in between two different kinds of responsibility and how to manage this, right? So we got into all of those kinds of stories and all of those dramas, like the many kinds of life that people were living in the shadow of this corporate form. So one thing to note is that, you know, Pujo has experience. He actually grew up on a plantation, a tea plantation in Java, and has studied it both ethnographically and also historically. So, you know, he started this with expertise in plantations that I didn't have. And he recognized many things right from the beginning, which I would not have noticed on my own. But, you know, I also brought fresh eyes to it. So there's also the element of, you know, two anthropologists, each with somewhat different training and somewhat different reading and prior experience, kind of confronting this landscape. So that's the kind of the overview. So what it looks and smells and feels like depends a little bit on who you are and where you are, you know, in this variegated landscape. And that's what you would really get a good sense of from the book, you know, from the different chapters of the book, which take different slices through that. But overall, the big argument that we make in the book is that the way to understand the arrival of these plantations is as a form of what we call corporate occupation. So that's a harsh term, but that's the one we came to based on our ethnographic study and trying to make sense of what we had found. And so you ask what it feels like. To me, it felt threatening. You're in an environment, there's a massive corporation there. They have offices you can't, you know, ordinary people can't go in. They're run by people they don't know. There are guards at the gate. So, you know, it has a sort of encampment military garrison kind of feel to it, but it's not that it's militarized, right? We actually saw no guns and we saw no physical violence. But on the one hand, you know, the plantation has occupied a massive area of people's land. So that's fact one. The land has been literally occupied. But the second element is the kind of political structures of an occupation. If you think of other things you may have read about occupied zones, one of the ways that occupations work is by dividing the population and identifying allies, collaborators, and people who in one way or another will become complicit with the occupation, right? That's how you survive an occupation in many cases, is you collaborate with it, you become complicit with it, you search for angles for how you can survive. Given that you can't make the occupier go away, right? The occupation force is there. You can't kick it out. You have to live there. But the presence of this occupation force does infect all political relationships, you know, at the local level. So village officials, caught between their people and the plantation, customary chiefs, co-opted by the plantation company, you know, become what the locals call company men. The whole question of who can you trust? Whose side are you on? Are you on the company side or on our side? You know, dividing the population is a common occupation tactic. So we came up initially when I was looking at my field notes, I mentioned this in the lecture the other day, I had written in my margin notes in many places, like, this is a war zone. These people are at war, you know, because it was that level of kind of tension and hostility and feeling oppressed and also feeling that it was kind of unaccountable. You couldn't talk to anyone in authority. You couldn't get a problem solved. But Pujo said, yeah, but war in Indonesia, like perang, like that really does mean armed conflict. It didn't really quite capture it. So it was at that point that we started thinking, well, how else can we capture this sense of oppression, which is not, you know, at the end of a gun necessarily, although, you know, there is some violence, but which is really built into the environment and the way that political relationships and ultimately the entire quality of citizenship, you know, has been restructured by the presence of these corporations. So that's what we discuss and theorize in terms of corporate occupation. And before we had hit on that terminology in our first draft of the book, we had a chapter which we called a sense of unease. And we're thinking, you know, what's unease as an analytic? Like, it's not really good enough, right? But what we were trying to capture was this sense of things don't feel right here. Nothing is quite normal here. You don't know who you can trust here. You don't know how you can solve a problem here. You don't know who is, you know, who's in charge. If you find that your field has been ruined by effluent from a mill, you can't do anything about it. You know, you can't do anything about it. Like, that what does that produce? Like anger, yes, fury, frustration. But the deepest one is just like, it doesn't feel right. You know, it's nothing feels quite settled. Nothing feels as it should be. So we experimented with war and unease, and it wasn't really good enough analytically. So then we hit on occupation, which gave us a way of really kind of trying to capture both the oppressive nature of living under corporate occupation, but also the kinds of affects that it generates, you know, the sense of we are stuck here, you know, we're captured here. We can't fix this. We can't make it go away. We have to live with it. But then we have to become a thief. Who wants to be a thief? That's a terrible way to live. All our neighbors and our headmen, they're all thieves. They've all become thieves because that's what it is to live under occupation, right? So you can see the kind of deep structure there, which is a really uneasy one, right? And that was how we made sense of it after years of poring over our data and trying to figure out like how could we explain and also convey a sense of the form of life.
That is such an amazing insight into like these affective dimensions and like what's destroyed and what's put over this. Like I'm really like, wow, like I can't wait to now get even further into the book because I just want to learn more about all of these amazing things that you're bringing up. Like, I think that it's sometimes so hard to picture from where we stand, you know, or at least where I stand in the middle of Helsinki in the global north, like really imagining these places. And I really appreciate this like glimpse into it. So should the spread of plantations be stopped? I mean, what are the implications of continued plantationization?
So for Indonesia, I would argue very strongly that yes, they should be stopped, actually. You know, 22 million hectares, a third of Indonesia's farmland has already been signed over in corporate land concession. Like that is vast. That's basically saying our rural will henceforth all be, or in, you know, huge part, be a plantation zone. And given the way that I've just described a plantation zone as a zone in which normal citizenship does not apply, in which we live under occupation with very truncated rights and forms of leadership, you know, there's not much you can do when your land is taken. If you're mistreated as a laborer, you want to go complain to the Ministry of Labor or the Department of, you know, Worker Affairs in the district capital, they too are being paid by the corporations, you know, a coordination fee. So, you know, there's the sense that there's no outside, you know, the normal structures of law and government, which ought to protect you, are really highly compromised by corporate occupation. So I think that's a terrible way to live. And a lot of people in our research area also thought it was a terrible way to live, right? They want to be ordinary citizens who can rely on their headman to be their headman and represent them and not to be an employee of the corporation. And they want their district head and their sub-district head and their customary leaders to be the same, right? To be actually accountable to them in a normal way. Now, Indonesian, you know, grassroots democracy leaves a lot to be desired. It's not to paint that as some sort of happy functional space, but it's a lot better than what comes up when you bring the enormous power of a corporation with a license for 20,000 hectares arrives waving its license. And as the district sub-district head said to us, they think they can do what they like. They have the concession. They think it's theirs. They think they can do what they want now. And they don't even have to answer to us in any way. So the power that a concession license gives to a corporation to do what it wants is a formidable power. So 22 million hectares of that, do you really want a third of Indonesian countryside to be a plantation zone? I don't think so. So something that we were trying to do with the book was to point out these kinds of deep structures. And the reason is because in some ways we're pushing back against the argument that plantation corporations, some are good and some are bad. And the bad ones need to be improved, you know, they need to be tamed. They need to be made to obey the rules and play nice and, you know, be better at their processes of land acquisition and so on. But at the end of the day, somebody with a concession license is still going to have these powers and the land is still going to be occupied by 20,000 hectares of monocrop palms and whatever was there before will be gone. However nice the plantation, right? That's the point, is that the corporate form in itself, however virtuous and well-meaning the corporation, the plantation form itself has these effects of eroding citizenship, eradicating livelihoods, and also closing off options for other forms of life into the future. You know, you're basically putting a lot of eggs in one basket, you know, 22 million hectares of monocrop palm is a huge risk. And the risk will be paid by the people who live in these areas, right? In these what could one day be ruined landscapes, which will be very hard to repurpose to grow other things because they've been severely simplified, you know, simplified ecologically and, you know, hillsides mowed down to create terraces and so on. It's going to take a real long time for other forms of agriculture and livelihood to come back into these spaces. And so there's a massive risk of doing this, an ecological risk, potentially a market risk, but also the one we've really foregrounded, a social and political risk in terms of, you know, this question of the form of life. So right now, of the 22 million hectares assigned to plantations, about 12 million has been built. And so there's still an opportunity, there's a couple of opportunities. Like one would be to stop issuing any more licenses, like 22 million, more than enough, stop now, right? I think one could really make the argument that is more than enough and that there should be zero new plantation licenses issued in any part of the country would be step one. Step two would be all of the areas which have already been allocated but haven't yet been developed. Could this be returned? You know, could this be returned to the people whose land it was before and, you know, deployed by them for more diverse uses? Now, as I mentioned in my talk, Indonesian farmers are very interested in growing oil palm. It's a highly lucrative crop, but they'd like to grow it in their own way on their own land and not under corporate occupation, right? So there's lots of potential to develop this land for oil palm and other crops. But the argument would be leave it in the hands of the farmers and the communities that already live there, whose land it is, and who are extremely capable of developing it, especially if they had some support. So far, though, all of the support has been for corporations and nothing has been done really to provide infrastructure and support to farmers in these areas to develop a highly productive agriculture. They still manage to be very productive, but they could do so much better if there was a shift in orientation to saying, let's quit believing in the corporations and let's start believing in our farmers and in our people and in our communities and in their energy, in capacity and enthusiasm to be productive farmers, which they've shown for 300 years. You know, Indonesian farmers have repeatedly gotten involved in cash crop production when a new crop has come along that's been lucrative. They've never been shy of markets or intensifying production or sometimes even monocropping, right? If a crop was really lucrative, like they go all in, but they go all in on their own terms and not as, you know, conscripts of a corporation. So I think there's a lot that could be done with that area, which has already been assigned but not yet developed. And then the third thing would be for the areas which are already under plantation license, and the advocates are, or which has already been developed as plantations, and the advocates are saying, well, the time for that is at renewal. You know, basically each of these things comes up for renewal after 35 years. That's the time to do a proper review and a reassessment of How are the people doing, you know, in the customary landholders, the people round about? Are they happy with how this has gone? Are they prospering? You know, the whole rationale for corporate plantations is that they bring development and jobs to rural areas. Well, let's see, you know, is there development? Are there jobs? Are the people doing well? And if not, then let's do a reset, right? And so the period of renewal is a period when those questions about continuing in the same form, continuing in a different form, which is more collaborative with the local communities, or not continuing at all, if the local communities really feel they've seen no benefit from this, only loss, that also has to be taken seriously. So I think there's lots that could be done, you know, to shift this picture, but the forces supporting continued corporate expansion are formidable. You know, if you follow the money, a lot of people make a huge amount of money out of this in different ways, not just the corporate profit, but also all of the payoffs, you know, the money that's paid for licensing, for protection, for extortion. Like there's money flowing all around this landscape, and we trace it in the book, and others have traced it at different levels. Like we trace it at the kind of plantation level, and others have traced it at the district level and nationally and so on. So there's lots of money about. These are highly lucrative, not just in terms of productivity, but also in terms of, you know, what one could think of as rent, the capacity of people to capture flows of wealth that they have not earned. That's the definition of rent. And there's a huge potential in the plantation economy for rent. So I would say that right now in Indonesia, the forces necessary to challenge that nexus are not strong. Could they become stronger? They have to, right? The alternative is really too scary. So, you know, these are questions for the decades ahead. And I think, you know, obviously they're questions for Indonesians to answer. We just hope that we're doing something useful in terms of bringing to light some of the deeper problems here, which really just don't come down to, oops, a bad corporation is treating its workers poorly. Oops, you know, somebody took land they shouldn't have. Oops. Like, it's not like that. This is an entire structure which has to be understood as a form that needs to be changed. So I don't think more plantationification? I don't think so. But that's what's happening, right? That is what's happening. So you know, as a parting shot, I would have to say that for 20 years, advocates in Indonesia and globally, you know, they've had lots of support from Scandinavian countries, Swedish, Norwegian, Finland. Like, there's been lots of people, Denmark, but all the Scandinavian countries have been very active in this advocacy around land, around labor, around human rights. Many European organizations are also involved. The EU is, you know, alert to the problems. And then there are other transnational organizations as well. And then there's a ton within Indonesia at all scales, you know, from the local level to their national advocacy organizations. But if you stand back, you'd have to say 20 years of critique, because we've known for a long time that this is problematic, has fantastically failed to stop the train. Because during 20 years of critique, another 20 million hectares has been allocated to plantation corporations, right? So whatever we're doing in terms of advocacy has not worked. And yet one more study which shows that, oops, this is going wrong, and oops, there's a human rights problem here, and there's a land problem there, and there's a pollution problem here. It's like, we know all of this, but it isn't changing. And that's really the conundrum, right? I mean, to be realistic about what advocacy has and hasn't achieved, and also about what measures such as sustainability initiative. What would it be like? 22 million hectares of monocrop palm is sustainable? Like, on what planet, right? I mean, on the planet which says Sustainability is defined as not tiptoeing your little toe over the edge of a protected area. So long as you don't infringe on protective areas, you're environmentally sustainable. But that's clearly nuts, right? So, you know, the existing mechanisms to tame the giants are not working, and the giants are proliferating. So, you know, something needs to change here. More of the same is not going to do it, unfortunately.
Absolutely. And thank you for all that. I mean, there's so much that I wish we could get into with connections to global systems and driving this and the geopolitical changes over the past 20 years and everything. But we know that you have a lot on your plate today, and we're so grateful to have you. And at the end of every interview,
we ask a question.
Oh no, is it question time?
It is question time.
Question team.
Our final question is the question, which is sort of a call to action for our listeners. For the people sitting at home listening to this, they hear it, they're moved, they want to do something. It could be reading something. It could be changing something in their daily life. What do you recommend for our listeners to be able to do something in relation to this?
That's really complex, and I have to say a bit troubling, right? Because I think, you know, the idea that you can click here or donate there is precisely, sadly, one of the ways that this system that I've just described is sustained. You know, because, you know, give money to the World Wildlife Fund. Well, they're involved in these certification schemes, and they are making the argument that what they call bad oil can become good, right? So many of the, there's a lot of, you could call it greenwash, you know, there's a lot of it about. So I think the most, productive frontier would be really to do some deep questioning of corporate-led development. Like, why does a country like Indonesia or other countries, Canada and others, what is the thinking which insists that only a corporation can get the job done, and that the farmers, the people, the small businesses are somehow incapable of developing their own economy, right? We repeatedly are setting up these vast monopolies in the name of what? Efficiency, you know, profit, productivity, somehow this image that you have to go to a global corporation to get the job done. But this, you know, as I argued in my talk, this is a fundamentally colonial lens, right? It suggests that the people on the spot are incompetent. Are we in Canada incompetent? Are, you know, are farmers in Indonesia incompetent? I don't think so. But we are being driven down a path in which the faith in corporations and the benefits that they can bring are not sufficiently challenged. And so this you know, affects many areas of life, but it also affects agriculture, you know, where it's actually farmers, small scale farmers, who have fed the world and produced cash crops in most places for most of history. And we're now going to just like kick them all aside and replace them with a corporation that says it can do it better? Really? I don't think so, right? So I think that what I would just suggest as a takeaway is, you know, think about the big structure here. Don't just think, you know, what's my quick fix or my cheap fix, but what actually would need to change in the way we understand what people are capable of and the forms of development that we would like to see in the world. And think about, you know, how can we get onto that path? Because the one we're on is truly damaging.
What better strong message to end on? It is a damaging path. I agree. Definitely. Well, thank you so much for taking some time out of your day to have this conversation with us here today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
A huge thank you to Tanya Murray Lee for coming on and sharing her thoughts and experience with us. Please join us next month when we'll be talking with Geddes Lasutis about extractivism, precarity, and violence in Mozambique.
From the icy sidewalks and bright sunny days of Helsinki, Finland, I am Christopher Shagnon. On behalf of Sofia Hagelani-Elbov, thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.